It is Sunday, June 3rd, 2012. This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Coming up on Weekend Ozarks, why the stories behind some of classical music's most famous works matter and can make listening to the works more enjoyable. But first, the 2012 annual Walmart shareholders meeting celebrating the company's 50th anniversary was not entirely golden. A scandal alleging the company paid out millions of dollars in bribes to facilitate store construction in Mexico overshadowed the gathering. And as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the issue also spurred protests both outside the gathering and inside.
9,000 Walmart shareholders plus an additional 5,000 invited associates from 27 nations converged in Fayetteville on the U of A campus this week to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the world's largest retailer, enjoying barbecue, free vendor samples, and of course, live outdoor music. Papa Rap and his Latin jazz ensemble got the crowd to their feet Thursday morning. The entire area was heavily guarded with lots of security, however, making it difficult for even media to get in. And this 200-square-foot fenced-in area, across from the festivities, is the designated protest site set up by the local police. And it stands empty. Instead, protesters, all of them longtime associates, circulated among the crowds distributing leaflets seeking petition signatures. And all are members of Our Walmart, OUR being an acronym for Organization United for Respect, anchored by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and allied with sister organization Making Change at Walmart.
So I'm Gershrila Green and I work at the LA Walmart 2960. The conditions in our store are very poor. When Walmart first came into LA, they made a promise that they would always staff us at 400 and start most associates off at $13 an hour. Well, they didn't keep that promise. And as we all know, their integrity is being questioned all the time now because they rarely keep promises that they make. Most of the time, we're high in injuries and low in bonuses, which we know Mike Duke is bonusing at least $18 million a year when every third quarter, sometimes associates don't bonus at all.
Gershrila Green and three other associate colleagues co-sponsored proxy ballot item number 6 at this year's annual shareholders meeting, seeking more transparency in executive compensation. They claim hours and pay are being cut as executive bonuses increase. Presenting proxy number 6 Friday morning at the shareholders gathering was Kenosha, Wisconsin 24-year Walmart veteran Jackie Gable.
The executives continue to get multi-million dollar bonuses. Our proposal is a simple one. We want the board to improve its disclosure to explain why bonus incentives for senior executives are the right ones, because as far as we can tell, our company is placing too much emphasis on growth at any cost. Here in the U.S., we are building new super centers just down the road from existing ones, and as the company acknowledges, the new stores are taking sales away from the older and existing stores. There's a serious problem for our company. But here's what makes it worse. The bonus incentive for executives seems to encourage this. When same-store sales turn negative, you remove same-store sales from the bonus formula. When return on investment went down year after year, you lowered the ROI targets so the executives could continue to get million-dollar bonuses anyway. But there are two groups of people who paid a price, the shareholders and the associates.
The measure, as expected, failed because for any proxy measure to be adopted, it would require 1.7 billion votes to supersede the Walton family holdings, whose Walton Enterprises control nearly 50% of a total 3.4 billion shares. Other proxy ballot items included electing a health care advocate to the board, with Walmart reportedly looking to develop a primary health clinic sector. Another ballot measure sought transparency regarding Walmart's political contributions and paid lobbyists. Imprinted on every single ballot, Walmart requested shareholders reject all four of those. None of them passed. Sources from the labor-backed protest groups told KUAF they were able to meet with Walmart's senior VP of labor relations, Karen Casey, several times during the week. But after Jackie Gable delivered proxy item number 6 to shareholders, she took the opportunity from the floor to chastise company executives who are being investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice for allegedly breaching the Foreign Corrupt Trade Practices Act by paying out $24 million in bribes to Mexican bureaucrats and builders to facilitate store construction in Mexico.
When some people are so focused on growth at any cost, they forgot our code of ethics. We have all felt the pain, the scandal, and the dishonor that this has brought to our company. But this didn't happen overnight. Sam Walton said, listen to your associates. They are your best idea generators.
Sources at our Walmart headquarters in Washington told KUAF that when the shareholders' meeting ended, Gable was mobbed by enthusiastic co-workers. Since news of the scandal broke, three major institutional shareholders, the New York City Pension Fund, California State Teachers Retirement System, and the California Public Employees Retirement System, have come forward saying they've lost confidence in the company's ruling hierarchy. And the scandal has angered certain shareholders who are campaigning to bar Walmart president and CEO Mike Duke, who was head of international operations for Walmart at the time, then president and CEO and current board member H. Lee Scott, as well as board chair Robson Walton from board reelection. Their Get Out the Vote campaign is using direct mail, phone banks, and social media, as well as petition signatures. Venancy Luna collected signatures all week from shareholders. As of broadcast time, she'd collected more than 17,500.
My name is Venancy Luna. I work for store number 2886, which is Pico Rivera Walmart at in Los Angeles. I'm a department manager. I worked there for 7 years. I started a petition against Mike Duke and Rob Walton because Walmart has lost their way of things the way they're supposed to be. The bribery where they paid $24 million to Mexico, it's not nice what they did, but yet they shouldn't get away with it either.
But as the Friday shareholders meeting wrapped, Walmart CEO and President Mike Duke took to the stage to acknowledge the anniversary, the company's success in a down economy, and to directly address the scandal.
I want to personally assure you, we're doing everything we can to get to the bottom of this matter, and we will take the appropriate actions when the investigations are complete. But let me go ahead and speak directly to all of our leaders here and to all of our associates here at Walmart. If you work for Walmart, there is no gray area between right and wrong.
Still, a majority of shareholders at this gathering appeared quite satisfied with their lot because in a down economy, Walmart is actually growing. Fiscal year 2012, Walmart netted a record $15.7 billion, returning $11.3 billion to shareholders through dividends and repurchasing of shares. And the first quarter of fiscal year 2013 rocked even financial analysts' predictions, with Walmart stores' overseas sales helping the retailer see more than 10% increase in profit. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about our Walmart, visit forrespect.org.
That was part of the story that took place Friday morning at Bud Walton Arena. Ify, you were inside Bud Walton for the spectacle. First time you've attended the shareholders meeting.
That is correct.
You came back and said it was kind of a circus.
It was a riot.
Yes. Celebrity studded.
Yes. And it started with Justin Timberlake. And that's when my jaw dropped because I really liked Justin Timberlake. But The rest of it wasn't a surprise, but it was very, people were very excited. It was quite a spectacle, I must say.
And here is Ithi's report, as it aired Friday night, about the spectacle that is the Walmart shareholders meeting.
I think that Walmart and Sam's undoubtedly will be the greatest retailing force that the world's ever seen. Isn't it true? The more you help someone else, the more it helps yourself become a better person.
It was the sound of founder Sam Walton's voice that marked the beginning of the 2012 annual Walmart shareholders meeting and Golden Jubilee celebrations this morning inside the Bud Walton Arena in Fayetteville. The space, home to the Razorback basketball teams, was packed with close to 14,000 people, 9,000 shareholders and 5,000 associates from all over the world. The meeting began with Rob Walton, chairman of the board of directors of Walmart Stores Incorporated, welcoming the crowd against the backdrop of Sam Walton's original Walton Five and Dime store in Bentonville that now serves as the Walmart Visitors Center.
A long time ago, and stepping through those doors brings back lots of memories of the early days, spending time in this 5 and 10 cent store in Bentonville with my brothers and my sister. It was a really special time and place. It was where Dad experimented with his own blend of new ideas and timeless values that would change retail forever. It's where we cut our teeth. We didn't know it then, but it became the foundation for everything that's followed.
Walton then invited his sister Alice Walton and brother Jim Walton, who's also a member of the board of directors, on stage to share stories about growing up in the Walton household and running the family business.
My favorite job, 10-cent jumbo popcorn. We had bags this big, and Dad figured out that the movie theater down the street on Saturday sold little bitty bags of popcorn for 10 cents. So we set our popcorn machine right outside the front of the store and happily gave it to all the movie customers. Three times as much popcorn.
Walmart associates from all over the world started arriving in Northwest Arkansas earlier this week. According to Erica Jones from Walmart Corporate Affairs, the 5,000 associates from 27 countries, including the United States, were selected by their peers to attend the meeting. Not all stores are represented at the shareholders' meetings and are alternated each year, even and odd numbers. Walmart operates more than 10,000 stores around the globe. In-country coordinators choose the apparel associates wear, and each nation wears certain colors. Dressed in these bright, colorful T-shirts, the associates took every opportunity to explore what the region has to offer, including Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art and the tiniest Walmart on the planet here on Garland Avenue in Fayetteville. Earlier this week, question and answer sessions with top Walmart executives were also hosted at Embassy Suites in Rogers. This morning, after welcoming the shareholders and associates, Rob Walton welcomed the MC of the event.
You know, there's one other thing that Dad taught us, too, and that was not to take ourselves too seriously and have a little fun. He used to do hokey stuff. I still remember he lost a bet to David Glass one time about how much percentage profit the company could make, and he had to do a hula on Wall Street, right on Wall Street, and that was hokey. But anyway, we survived. Oh my gosh. I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Justin Timberlake.
Timberlake, wearing a hula skirt, drew wild applause from the audience. Then, the jokes began.
Now, you know, when I was contacted to host the 50th anniversary shareholders meeting, I was excited. So, as a responsible host, I began to do some research on Walmart. Tons and tons and hours, hours research. Basically, I Googled Walmart. And
the morning was star-studded, so much so that at times it was easy to forget that it was a business meeting after all. Videos starring Walmart associates and Timberlake's jokes preceded and followed performances by Zac Brown Band from Atlanta, Georgia. Popular Latin American singer Juanes. Lionel Richie.
Come on and sing along, everybody, all night long. I can't hear your turn.
And another singer-songwriter who was introduced as a Walmart shopper from Nashville, Tennessee.
You guys really do like the customers. Okay, so, hi, what's your name and where are you from?
My name's Taylor, I'm from Nashville.
Right. Nashville. Taylor, what do you do for a living in Nashville?
I'm a singer.
Of course you are. A singer. Whatever. I guess if you're a singer and you live in Nashville, you're probably a songwriter too.
Yeah, and I have 6 Grammys too.
Okay. Waitress.
And Timberlake wasn't the only one cracking jokes. President and CEO of Walmart International, Doug McMillon, while discussing the importance of localizing everyday products such as Coca-Cola, took an opportunity to add a mix of spices to the soda drink before offering it to his boss, President and CEO of Walmart Stores Incorporated, Michael Duke.
I know you've been to India a lot. Have you ever had a masala Coke? Welcome. Give it a try. He liked it, I think. What do you think?
Fantastic.
Fantastic, he says. Fantastic. Thanks for trying it and demonstrating it for everyone. You know that taste you have in your mouth right now? That's going to be there for about 48 hours. They had me try that the other day, and I thought, I have got to do this to somebody else.
The morning also saw Sean Baldwin, Senior Vice President of Fresh for Sam's Club US, being presented with the 2012 Sam Walton Entrepreneur Award. During the final hour, a mix of performances by artists from countries including South Africa, China, and the US was followed by a flag march with associates from the 27 countries Walmart boasts its presence in, carrying the respective flags. Remarks by Walmart Stores Incorporated President and CEO Michael Duke and a performance by singer Celine Dion marked the end of this year's event, but the sentiment shared by Rob Walton at the very start of the meeting indicated the beginning of another enthusiastic, forward-looking 50 years.
Little did we know, 50 years ago, when we opened the first store in Rogers, we had only just begun. And 20 years ago, when Dad handed over Walmart to the next generation of leaders, we had only just begun. And today, as we stand on the edge of a new era in retail, we've still only just begun to help people save money and live better. Do you believe it? Do you agree?
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. In less than 2 weeks, the first music from the Artisphere Orchestra will begin to be heard as part of the Artisphere Festival that is sponsored by the Walton Arts Center. Last week, Jason Smith with Walton Arts Center came in. We were discussing classical music. Jason, I've invited you back. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Last week, you were talking about perhaps people who think they aren't classical music fans explore.
Yes.
You know, find out, because you probably are. We probably all are to some degree. And you mentioned that some Aaron Copland music was used, you know, for the Beef Council.
Exactly.
Now, here's the thing. Aaron Copland didn't write that so someday it would encourage you to eat beef.
Of course not.
And I think one of the great things about music that we're talking about is so much of it is formed by what's happening in that composer's life, and it's not written as a jingle.
Not at all. In fact, that piece was written as a dance suite,
right,
for Martha Graham. And, you know, you in that piece, if you listen to it in its entirety, the piece that you hear in the commercial is the very last movement. And probably it is the most recognizable movement, but it all ties in to this dance that's celebrating the American West and the new frontier. And within that piece itself, you know, Aaron Copland was more concerned with imitating the canter of a horse mm-hmm. than he was with selling the idea of beef.
Right.
You know?
And because he did it so well, it's probably one reason the Beef Council eventually adopted that.
Of course.
Because it did invoke the West, which made you think of steer or whatever.
Exactly. And the cowboy, the cowpoke. And,
right.
You know, I mean, and there, it's amazing what he has written into his score that has become iconic for Western culture and the American West and that Oklahoma-Texas frontier land, which really was what they were looking for when they were developing the dance.
So much of the music that falls under the umbrella of classical music was inspired by something. It might be war. It might be the threat of war. It might be the end of war.
Exactly. I think that some of Beethoven's pieces, well, at least one of them, was written to honor Napoleon. You know, I mean, arguably one of the more violent dictators in European history. Of course, it's a war that's different from war that we have in our modern sensibility. But, when wars were heroic and everybody wore red and blue. But he wrote a symphony that was going to be dedicated to the memory of Napoleon. And then, you know, of course, he famously struck out Napoleon's name on it.
Does it help to know the stories? You don't have to, but if you know, I'm fortunate because I get to talk to composers or conductors.
Right.
Several times throughout the year. And mm-hmm. when it's discussing a particular program that's going to be – and they can tell a backstory.
Right.
And say, well, if you listen here, this is when this Russian composer was really – you can hear his hope here or his dismay in what might be happening to his country. You don't have to know, but doesn't it help?
I think the more information you have and the more informed you make yourself on any level, I think the more helpful it is. I don't think it's – necessary, but I think it certainly will open your eyes to see it as the composer intended. Having worked with several wonderful conductors, several of them have said, you know, the intent and the reason why we study the score is to learn what the conductor wanted. And part of the process of learning the music is to know where it was composed, what they were doing at that time, things that led up to that, whether it is cultural like a war, or whether it's they were living in a time of, you know, of the divine right kings, you know, kings and queens and monarchs of Europe, which informs how classical music is looked at. You know, I mean, I like to always talk to kids and go, well, you know, when this piece was written, let's think about how people just in their daily lives lived. Did they have TVs?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have record players?
Right.
You know, did this composer, what did he do? Did he have a kitchen? You know, could he cook in his house? You know, or did he live out in the country? Learning how to ask those questions And then seeking out those answers is really helpful to understanding maybe why a composer chooses a subject matter. Strauss wrote this piece called The Alpine Symphony, mm-hmm. and it requires an enormous orchestra. It's one of the it's so enormous that it's rarely performed as compared to other pieces. And it literally details the day of the sun rising over the Alps. And then setting, and follows what a day in the Alps would be like musically.
Right.
And why did he choose that? Why was it important for him to create a whole symphony based on that? That's the question. It can open up conversations with yourself and with others that can be just thrilling experiences in your daily lives.
I may be painting with a broad brush here. I'm going to take some big terms. But is that one way that classical music might have a connection to popular music? If you think of Bob Dylan and Blowin' in the Wind, which was written thinking about Vietnam and civil unrest, or Sam Cooke and A Change is Going to Come About Civil Rights. I mean, these are songs inspired by things. Now, they're songs. They're not symphonies.
Right.
But is that one way we can kind of make a connection between?
Well, I think that's a very valid connection. I think the only difference might be that in classical music, you can't pick it up in 2 minutes.
Right. Right.
The same message might be developed over 10 minutes.
A short story versus a novel.
I would say it's more like a paragraph versus a paragraph, which is kind of a popular format, which is a mm-hmm. shorter format, to maybe 10 pages.
Gotcha.
If the novel is an entire composer's work.
Most of what we've talked about so far is about hearing the music as it is recorded on a CD or something. But of course, what the Artisphere Orchestra is about is hearing it live. And there is a difference. We'll need to talk about that.
You bet.
Can we do that next week?
You bet.
Okay. Thank you, Jason.
You got it.
Oh, if people want to know more about the Artisphere Orchestra and the performances?
Go to artispherefestival.org. Under featured projects, you can see the orchestra and the chamber music series. And it will give you all the times and dates. And I encourage you to come out.
Thank you. Jason Smith is with the Walton Arts Center and is helping us get ready for the performances of the Artisphere Festival Orchestra. The first music from musicians involved with the orchestra will be in 11 days. On June 14th, there will be an evening of Harp and Friends at Mildred B. Cooper Chapel in Bella Vista. The first of three concerts with the entire 80-plus musician ensemble will be June 17th on the campus of John Brown University in Siloam Springs.
Jack White used to chafe at critics who wanted him to keep making the same White Stripes record over and over again. And then he read a series of scathing reviews from 1967 of Sgt. Pepper's.
I mean, what did they want the Beatles to do, for goodness sakes? they wanted them to rewrite, A Hard Day's Night or something.
The continuing evolution of Jack White. That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News. The people around me won't let
me come. All Things Considered, this afternoon at 4 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Michael Clark Donat was a photographer and builder of cameras and an inspiration to many other photographers and artists. He died in 2010, but his legacy will continue with a unique tribute next month at the Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. 20 professional photographers will each have an image in the exhibit. Each of the pictures taken with one of Donat's handmade wooden pinhole cameras. Don House, a photographer, helped organize the event. Don and Michael's widow, Leela, recently talked with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about the artist's life and the exhibit that opens June 5th.
Art exhibitions often showcase the work of a single artist, but during the month of June, an exhibit at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale will feature the work of 20 photographers in honor of one man. Michael Clark Donat was a local photographer who joined the Northwest Arkansas Times in the late 60s. He worked for them for several years before setting out on his own. In addition to taking photographs, he would process film of high school football games here in Northwest Arkansas and Oklahoma, and then deliver it to the coaches the next day so they could review the game. Lila Donat, who married Mike in 1972, recently came by the KUAF studio along with photographer Don House, who is organizing the exhibit. After moving to the area about 25 years ago, Don says it seems like Mike's life paralleled his because they worked in the same space and shared clients over the years. The exhibition at the ACO features photographs taken with a wooden pinhole camera Mike built. Don recalls happening upon the beautiful pinhole camera at Collier's Drugstore years ago and buying it. When he began printing negatives for the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, Don says they had the best darkroom he had ever worked in. He soon discovered that was because Mike had the job previously and had donated an impressive amount of equipment to the museum. It served as a reminder that Mike was still in Northwest Arkansas, so Don contacted him, and about once a week, Mike would come to the museum for coffee and a chat.
What I didn't realize is that at that time, Mike had been diagnosed with cancer, and he was just starting treatments. And as those progressed, then I would start going to his house, and we just had a little ritual where he would supply coffee, and I would stop at the Spring Street Grill and get pecan pie or something. Or if we were very lucky, Lila would have made something and left it at the house and eat that. And so we would just talk for an hour or two at the house and talk about everything but cancer. I think that was the unspoken agreement. It was a chance to talk about other things, you know, in his life. This pinhole camera just stuck with me. It was just such a, it is such a combination of fine art and fine craft. And Mike makes all, every part of it, the metal, the, you know, the wooden parts, the metal parts, and he assembles it, tests them. Lila knows more about that process than I do. But I decided that the pinhole represented a lot of things about Mike that I thought of being able to combine photography with, I mean, an ancient form of photography, really, in a way, with modern old construction, modern construction, and then film, and kind of wrapped it up in one unit there of what I thought of as inventive and multi-talented. So there are a lot of photographers who knew and loved Mike and had dealt with him over the years. So I put together a list of photographers that I knew had interactions with Mike, and then also photographers who had not met him. And I wanted each of those photographers to take the camera that Mike had made, and without any input from me, no instructions really, it was just to take it, use it in the kind of photography that they enjoyed doing, but to use that camera. And then at the end, of the year, it's been about a year or so in the making, that the only condition was that they had to make a print and give it to me ready to hang at an exhibition at the ACO that's coming up in June. And it's been great.
Now, Lila, when he came up with the idea for this exhibition, did he talk to you about it? Have you been involved in this process at all?
Yes, been involved since the very beginning. It was something that our family was really enthusiastic about. It's just such a great honor to have all the photographers take a picture with the camera that Mike made. And Don mentioned that I probably know more about putting it together. Actually, I only know the sound of the machines in the garage putting it together because that's where all the equipment was. We never parked a car in our garage. It was just full of a metal lathe, all kinds of woodworking tools that I don't really know the names of. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so... So late night sounds of all that equipment running.
Well, you've brought a pinhole camera here, Don, and it's this little wooden box, and it's got a little metal handle on the side. But can you tell me how it works?
Well, it does look like a piece of cabinetry, doesn't it?
It does.
It's just beautifully made. It looks like it's made from either mahogany or walnut. I think this is walnut. And really, a pinhole camera in its basic form is nothing more than a box made out of almost anything. And in one end of it is a very small hole, an extremely small hole that you can cover up. And on the back of it, or inside of it, you have a sheet of film or a piece of photographic paper. So in Mike's camera, it's a little more sophisticated in that he has a couple controls to be able to cover the little hole and a nice way of attaching film to the back of it using a kind of a standard 4x5 large format film holder that photographers would be very familiar with. So in this case, and it's got a nice handle for carrying it, and in this case, film is loaded in the back. You set it on a tripod because the exposures are long. The hole is so small and without a lens present that it takes it a while for enough light to get through there.
Now, you said with this particular exhibition that you didn't really give them any rules. They just had to take the camera and take a photograph with it. So have any of the artists contacted you during the course of the last year saying, okay, well, I think I'm going to photograph this? I mean, was there any planning so that two people didn't, say, photograph the same type of thing?
No. There were a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Some of the photographers, like today, I picked up a wonderful photograph from Tim Ernst, one of the photographers, who was able to figure out how to attach his digital camera back to the back of this pinhole box. And he had called when he had that idea to ask me if I thought it would be appropriate. And I told him, of course, and I thought that Mike would love that. And in fact, Mike would have been the one that Tim would have gone to figure out how to do that at one point. And so Mike would have loved it, and I did too. There's no conditions. Some photographers called and with questions because they haven't dealt with large format film. Mm. Many of them hadn't dealt with it in decades, and some had not used it at all. So this was new for them, and they loved it. I think they really enjoyed it. Every camera has a rhythm to it. 35 millimeter is totally different than this in how you approach a subject. And this is a slow, methodical, thoughtful kind of rhythm to it. And it's very pleasing. If you haven't done it before, you become addicted to it very quickly. It slows you down, and you evaluate what you're about to photograph a lot more than you would if you were shooting smaller format.
Now, 20 photographers sounds like a lot for just one exhibition, but I think when you look at Northwest Arkansas as a whole and how many talented photographers that we do have, it's actually not that many. So how did you guys kind of come up with that list? Did you have any input, Leela, in kind of pointing him like, maybe ask this person? Or
I did have a couple suggestions of people I knew that did photography, and of course Don's in the trade, so he has a better handle on who all is out there.
How did you come up with your suggestions? Were they people that your husband knew, or
people that we knew and had worked with? One is someone I worked with at my work, and then some friends also.
And have you gotten to see any of the finished products yet? Mm-hmm. Yourself?
No, just that this one? Except the one that Don brought. It's the only one, and the ones Mike took, of course. But.
Right, and you brought in a picture actually of Mike's. That is that going to be in the exhibition?
That's actually going to be what I guess with the little panel that tells a little bit more about Mike and stuff, and it's a picture he took at the Greek Theater with the pinhole.
So what are you hoping people will take away from this exhibition, people that come and see it? Maybe people that aren't familiar with pinhole camera, or maybe people that weren't necessarily familiar with your husband's work?
Well, I know our family is going to come away with it, just the whole joyous celebration. We were really lucky, and at the time that Mike had cancer, he was diagnosed and died 2.5 years later, that I don't think he ever complained about anything. He was extremely optimistic, totally optimistic. And this is just, for us, kind of a pleasant way. I mean, you have to go through all the grieving stages, and this is a great way to think about all the happy times. So for us, that's what it means.
How about for you?
Well, a chance to honor Mike. I know that I have the luxury of being able to speak lightly about subjects that were gut-wrenching for Leela and the family. For me, honoring Mike it's like I guess you can honor a photographer by having his work in a collection of a museum that may continue. But to me, having photographers using his creation to continue to create new art is a fantastic legacy. And there are cameras out there. I don't know how many he actually made. Leela may know that number.
Actually, I don't.
Well, dozens, perhaps.
I think probably maybe 40 at the most.
So 40 photographers out there, maybe internationally, I think one of his distributors was overseas, that are using his cameras and creating art today, I think is an amazing legacy. And I wanted people locally, I think in the region, the list of photographers is it's an impressive group for people who are following photography in this area. Tim Ernst, we already mentioned, Michael Pevin, Victor Chalfant, Andrew Kilgore, Kathy Mayhew, Jim Bailey, Richard Berquist, Jane Kellett, J.T. Wampler, Ron Lutz, Rick Green, Dan Wycliffe and Paul Williams from Colliers, Andy Shoup, Leslie Walker, Sabina Schmidt, I hope I haven't left anyone out, Joanne Jones. And these are photographers who have been serious photographers for many, many years. And having them apply their talents, I think, to this camera just means something to me anyway.
Don House and Leela Donat recently stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to discuss the Michael Clark Donat Memorial Pinhole Photography Exhibition, which will be on display at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale June 5th through the 29th. An artist's reception is scheduled for 6 to 8 p.m. June 7th. More information is available at artcenteroftheozarks.org.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, are Americans getting the full story about civilian casualties in the wake of U.S. drone strikes?
We seem to have this discord between what's being reported internationally and what's being reported within the United States, and I do wonder at that.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, this morning at 11 on KUAF. It may be hard for some of us to comprehend on this Sunday morning, but there are people right now waking up and dancing at Wakarusa. The four-day concert has been going practically nonstop since Thursday afternoon and will roll along through tonight. For some people, the festival is free. Well, almost. They have to put up some sweat equity for their ticket. Ozarks at Large's John Schlois has this report from the festival.
Wakarusa. The music festival at Mulberry Mountain near Ozark is now in its fourth year at Arkansas. Tickets for the four-day event cost about $200 and don't even include camping or a parking spot. About 400 people avoid this cost and actually get into the festival for free with the camping and parking spot. What's their secret? They work for their ticket. It's part of a program called the Work Exchange Team, or WET. You can see many of the volunteers in the large crowds because they're wearing light blue, WET t-shirts. The camping provided to those workers is in a secluded southwest corner of the festival grounds, behind two small ponds and on a dusty trail. The trail leads to the edge of a grove of trees that opens up to a large clearing full of bright red dirt and mud and rocks. This camping location isn't ideal, but it is included in their contract when they sign up to work. Main venue camping costs about $100 and is already sold out this year. I found Thomas Reed, a sophomore at Hendricks College, in the WET campsite. He explained the process of getting on the work exchange team.
Well, we just apply through the work exchange team, and they accept you, and then you have to put down a deposit, and then you just work, and you get a free ticket, and then if you complete all your hours, you get your deposit back.
The work exchange team is part of Shimon Presents out of Atlanta. Their mission is to provide a method for music fans to attend the festivals they want for free while also providing festivals a quality workforce. For Wakarusa, volunteers had to pay a non-refundable $15 application fee and put down a $220 deposit. If they work 15 hours, volunteers get their deposit back. I wandered over to the WET check-in booth, which is really like a barn. Volunteers were sitting on bales of hay and birds were flying around below the roof. There I found Kylie Dangerfield, a supervisor with WET. I asked her if it was common for volunteers to not show up for work.
It's, you know, their prerogative to not show up. They put down a deposit in the price of the ticket. So if they decide not to show up, they're essentially paying for the ticket and enjoying the festival. So we always plan ahead of time and use floaters. So in case people don't show up, we have extras and such. Yeah, I mean, it's broken into five-hour shifts. They can choose, like, the department they want to work in, friends they want to work with, and top three bands they don't want to miss. So we do a pretty good job of scheduling them around their needs.
Sometimes the hours are not very desirable. I asked Thomas Reed about his first shift this week.
It was directing people through parking in the South Gate, which is a couple miles down the road, and it was pretty boring.
When were you doing it?
From 10:45 p.m. to 9 a.m., so overnight, yeah.
With such terrible hours and a less than desirable camping area, I asked Reed why he decided to come to Wakarusa.
It's awesome. There's great music, great people, lots of fun stuff.
Another volunteer, Layla Rosen, who is also a student at Hendrix, said her first shift was a little bit longer than she expected.
I had a 12-hour shift, which I wasn't expecting. Part of it is, you know, you have to be flexible when they don't pick you up for 2 hours longer than they're supposed to, but, you know, you just roll with it and it's okay, so.
She didn't seem very upset working most of her hours in her first shift.
I think the biggest part of coming to a festival like this is just the atmosphere and the people. Everyone's just so laid back and, like, welcoming. I went to Bonnaroo with this one and this one last year, and we had an amazing time, but, like, we weren't really prepared camping-wise. We didn't have one of these big canopies, and I just wanted to have, like, that kind of experience again. But as a college student, I couldn't really, like, afford to keep going to music festivals, so the work exchange program is a really good way to do that.
Interested music fans can find more information about the Work Exchange Team by visiting their website, workexchangeteam.com. For Ozarks at Large, on location at Mulberry Mountain, I'm John Schlois.
It is Sunday, the 3rd of June, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Matolkai.
With us is Becca Martin-Brown. She is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Good morning.
Do you know anything about wine?
Not a lot, I have to admit, no.
You know it's Art of Wine Time.
Yes.
And there's something new this year that I think sounds fabulous. Alex Berry, who's the sommelier at the Wine Center in Fayetteville, yes, is doing Wine Tasting 101 at 5:30 on June 8th, which is Friday.
Yes.
And a Sparkling Wine Extravaganza at 4:30 on June 9th, which is Saturday. These are new to the 12-year-old festival. And apparently the keywords are swirl, sniff, swish, and spit.
All right.
I don't get it, but that's all right.
I know that wine has legs.
Yes.
It has legs.
But I don't know what those legs are.
good wine has legs.
Okay.
So go to this and you'll find out. Alex exactly will tell you. He'll be happy to tell you.
Here's the rest of the Art of Wine events. Winemaker's Dinner is at 6 o'clock on Thursday. It's $225.
Yes.
Wine Tasting 101 again on Friday. Uncorked. Mm-hmm. At 7 o'clock on June 8th, that's $75. The Wine Lovers Brunch is on Saturday the 9th, and it's $65. The Sparkling Wine Extravaganza again on the 9th, and that's $30. The Premier Wine Tasting is at 6 o'clock on the 9th, and that's $150. It's all at the Walton Art Center, and you can call them for tickets. I'm told they are available for all the events.
Okay.
The Mountain Street Stage Music Series is this afternoon.
Yeah, just across the street at Fayetteville Public Library.
Starts at 2 o'clock. Jonathan Trawick and friends are the performers today. It's Crafts on the Square Time at the Spark Cafe in Bentonville from 2 to 4. Kids can go and create a balloon globe. And it's First Sunday at Ozark Folkways near Winslow with Christian Underwood, nature photographer and cartographer. And that's from 2 to 4.
Well, we got First Thursdays, First Fridays, First Sundays. The first weekends of every
first
month.
First confused.
That's
yeah,
right. That's, that's great. Always something to do.
And thank today's also my mom's birthday.
Oh.
Oh, happy birthday, Mom. I know she can't hear us from
I
here.
I know, but it's okay.
The web, right? She could be listening.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is the features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 3rd of June, 2012. It's the birthday of Allen Ginsberg, born Newark, New Jersey, 1926. When he was 17, his freshman year at Columbia, Ginsberg was introduced to Jack Kerouac and William S. Burroughs, who were older. They were not in school. They were experimenting with drugs. They were trying to write. Ginsberg said they encouraged him to think for himself and not worry about conforming. 10 years later, he moved to San Francisco, where he was introduced to the poetry scene by Kenneth Rexroth. And he began work on a poem that would later be called Howl, a poem in which the length of a line was based on how much he could say in one breath. Today, it's one of the most recognized poems in literature. It sold nearly 1 million copies. He read a draft of the poem Howl at the Six Gallery on an October night in 1955 in San Francisco. Another poet who was there that night said the crowd left standing in wonder, knowing at the deepest level that a barrier had been broken, that a human voice and body had been hurled against the harsh wall of America. Lawrence Ferlinghetti had been at the reading, and the next day Ginsburg got a telegram from him at City Lights Press, which said, "Please send manuscript." Howl was published by City Lights the following year, 1956, and a year later, the publisher and the bookstore manager, who had sold the book to a couple of undercover cops, stood trial for obscenity. Most of the country had never heard of Allen Ginsberg until that trial, which caused a huge sensation. There was a story in Life magazine, and it made him famous. The judge returned a landmark ruling, said that although he himself was a God-fearing Sunday school teacher, he recognized that the poem had redeeming social importance. The poem beginning with the famous lines, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night." It's the birthday of Larry McMurtry, born just outside Wichita Falls, Texas, 1936, raised in nearby Archer City, came from three generations of ranchers. Larry McMurtry, who wrote Lonesome Dove and other historical novels, and novels that became popular movies, Terms of Endearment and The Last Picture Show. Larry McMurtry operated a used bookstore in Washington, D.C., and then he moved it to Archer City, 500,000 books in four separate buildings. This August, the store will host an enormous public auction of 350,000 books. And it's the birthday of the writer who put sex in the romance novel, Kathleen Woodiwiss, born in Alexandria, Louisiana, 1939. It was the success of her book, The Flame and the Flower, in 1972 that transformed the romance genre. Here's a poem for today by Allen Ginsberg, Fourth Floor, Dawn, Up All Night, Writing Letters. Pigeons shake their wings on the copper church roof, out my window, across the street. A bird perched on the cross surveys the city's blue-gray clouds. Larry Rivers will come at 10 a.m. and take my picture. I'm taking your picture, pigeons. I'm writing you down, dawn. I'm immortalizing your exhaust, Avenue A bus. Oh, thought. Now you'll have to think the same thing forever. Allen Ginsberg's poem, Fourth Floor, Dawn, Up All Night, Writing Letters, from his collected poems, 1947 to 1997, published by Harper Perennial Modern Classics, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mount Sequoia Retreat and Conference Center features Music on the Mountain the first Tuesday of every month. June, it's Donna Stierna and Songs from Her Kitchen Table. That takes place Tuesday night at 7. Walk-up tickets are available with proceeds to benefit the Restore Clap Auditorium Fund. Food and coffee provided. MountSequoia.org for more information. The Bentonville Farmers Market is open 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. each Saturday morning and 10 to 2 on Wednesdays. Located in Lawrence Plaza, just north of the downtown square, this market offers fresh produce, meats, cheeses, breads, and coffees, as well as handmade crafts, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More information is available at downtownbentonville.org or 254-0254.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Rule.
In Carroll County. Mm-hmm. Sister city to Rudd, by the way. Take my word for it. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar.
You'll be with us tomorrow at noon
That's
with an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I'll be back on Tuesday.
Thanks for listening.